I took that in with a second's glance, and then turned my back to stand beside him and face the crowd. Holding my open hands in front of me, pleading and placating, I shouted for the violence to stop. As I'd run forward and started the attempt to save the man, I'd had a fantasy that the crowd would part and listen to my voice. Stones would fall from the limp hands of mortified men. The mob, swayed by my eloquent courage, would wander away from the scene with shamed and downcast eyes. Even now, in my recollections of that moment and that danger, I sometimes surrender to a wish that my voice and my eyes had changed their hearts that day, and that the circle of hate, humiliated and disgraced, had widened and dispersed. Instead, the crowd hesitated for only an instant, and then pressed in upon us again in a brawling, hissing, screaming, boiling rage, and we were forced to fight for our lives. Ironically, the very numbers of the crowd attacking us worked to our advantage. We were trapped in an awkward L shape made by the tangle of vehicles. The crowd surrounded us, and there was no escape. But the crush of their numbers inhibited their movements. Fewer blows struck us than might have been the case had fewer men opposed us, and the thrashing crowd actually struck at themselves quite often in their fury. And perhaps there really was some softening of their fury, some reluctance to kill us, despite their urgent desire to cause us pain. I know that reluctance. I've seen it many times, in many violent worlds. I can't fully explain it. It's as if there is a collective conscience within the group mind of a mob, and the right appeal, at exactly the right moment, can turn murderous hate aside from its intended victim. It's as if the mob, in just that critical moment, want to be stopped, want to be prevented from the worst of their own violence. And in that one doubting moment, a single voice or fist raised against the gathering evil can be enough to avert it. I've seen it in prison, where men bent on the pack rape of another prisoner can be stopped by one voice that stirs their shame. I've seen it in war, where one strong voice can weaken and wither the hate-filled cruelty that torments a captured prisoner. And perhaps I saw it on that day, as the Nigerian and I struggled with the mob. Perhaps the strangeness of the situation, a white man, a Gora, pleading in Hindi for the lives of two black men, held them back from murder. The car behind us suddenly roared to life. The heavy-set driver had managed to start the car. He gunned the engine and began to gently reverse away from the wreckage. The passenger and I slowly shuffled and slithered along beside the car as it backed up into the crowd. We struck out, shoving men away from us and wrenching their hands from our clothes. When the driver reached backward over his seat and opened the rear passenger door, we both jumped into the car. The press of the crowd slammed the door. 20, 50 hands drummed, beat, slapped and pounded on the outside of the car. The driver pulled away, heading at a crawl along the Causeway Road. A collection of missiles, tea glasses, food containers, dozens of shoes, rained on the car. Then we were free, speeding along the busy road and watching through the rear window to make sure we weren't followed. "Hassan Obikwa," the passenger beside me said, offering his hand. "Lynn Ford," I replied, shaking his hand and noticing for the first time how much gold he wore. There were rings on every finger, some of them closed around blue-white glittering diamonds. There was also a diamond-encrusted gold Rolex hanging loosely at his wrist. "This is Rahim," he said, nodding to the driver. The huge man in the front seat glanced over his shoulder to offer me a broad grin. He rolled his eyes in a survivor's happy prayer and turned to face the road. "I owe you my life," Hassan Obikwa said with a grim smile. "We both do. They wanted to kill us back there, that's for sure." "We were lucky," I answered, looking into his round, healthy, handsome face and beginning to like him. His eyes and his lips defined his face. The eyes were unusually wide-set and large, giving him a slightly reptilian stare, and the marvellous lips were so full and sumptuously shaped that they seemed to be designed for a much larger head. His teeth were white and even at the front, but all the teeth on either side were capped with gold. Rococo curves at the corners of his wide nose gave his nostrils a delicate flair, as if he was constantly inhaling a pleasantly intoxicating scent. A wide gold earring, conspicuous beneath his short black hair and against the blue-black skin of his thick neck, pierced his left ear. I glanced at his torn, bloody shirt, and at the cuts and bruises that were swelling on his face and every exposed centimetre of flesh. When I met his eyes again, they were glittering with excited good humour. He wasn't too shaken by the violence of the mob, and neither was I. We were both men who'd seen worse and had been through worse, and we recognised that in each other immediately. In fact, neither of us ever mentioned the incident directly after that day of our meeting. I looked into his glittering eyes, and I felt my smile stretching to match his.
"We were damn lucky."
"Fuck yes, yes we were," he agreed, laughing hard and slipping the Rolex watch from his wrist. He held it to his ear to make sure it was still ticking. Satisfied, he snapped the watch back on his wrist and gave his full attention to me.
"But the debt is there, and the debt is still important, even if we were very lucky. A debt like this, it is the most important of all a man's obligations. You must allow me to repay you."
"It'll take money," I said. The driver glanced in the rear vision mirror and exchanged a look with Hassan.
"But this debt cannot be repaid with money," Hassan answered.
"I'm talking about the cart puller, the one you hit with your car, and the taxi you damaged. If you give me some money, I'll see that it gets to them. It'll go a long way to calming things down at Regal Circle. That's in my beat. I have to work there every day, and people are going to be pissed off for a while yet. Do that, and we'll call it square." Hassan laughed and slapped his hand on my knee. It was a good laugh, honest but wicked, and generous but shrewd.
"Please don't worry," he said, still smiling broadly. "This is not my area, it is true, but I am not without influence even here. I will make sure that the injured man receives all the money he needs."
"And the other one," I added.
"The other one?"
"Yes, the other one."
"The other what?" he asked, perplexed.
"The taxi driver."
"Yes, yes, the taxi driver also."
There was a little silence, humming with puzzles and questions. I glanced out of the window of the cab, but I could still feel his inquiring eyes on me. I turned to face him again.
"I like taxi drivers," I said.
"Yes."
I know a lot of taxi drivers."
"Yes."
"And that cab being smashed up, it'll cause a lot of grief for the driver and his family."
"Of course."
"So, when will you do it?" I asked.
"Do what?"
"When will you put the money up for the cart puller and the cab driver?"
"Oh!"
Hassan Obikwa grinned, looking up again into the rear vision mirror to exchange a look with Rahim. The big man shrugged and grinned back into the mirror.
"Tomorrow. Is tomorrow okay?"
"Yeah," I frowned, not sure what all the grinning was about. "I just want to know so that I can talk to them about it. It's not a question of the money. I can put the money up myself. I was planning to do it anyway. I've got to mend some fences back there. Some of them are acquaintances of mine. So that's why it's important. If you're not going to do it, I need to know so that I can take care of it myself. That's all." The whole thing seemed to be getting very complicated. I wished I'd never raised the matter with him. I began to feel angry at him, without really understanding why. Then he offered me his open palm in a handshake.
"I give you my word," he said solemnly,
and we shook hands. We were silent again, and after a few moments, I reached over to tap the driver on the shoulder.
"Just here is fine," I said,
perhaps a little more harshly than I'd intended.
"I'll get out here."
The car pulled into the curb, a few blocks from the slum. I opened the door to leave, but Hassan gripped my wrist.
It was a very strong grip. For a second, I calculated all the long way upward to the much greater strength I knew must be in Rahim's grip.
"Please, remember my name, Hassan Obikwa. You can find me at the African ghetto, in Anderi. Everyone knows me there. Whatever I can do for you, please tell me. I want to clear my debt, Lynn Ford. This is my telephone number. You can reach me from here at any time of the day or the night."
I took the card. It bore only his name and number, and shook his hand. Nodding to Rahim, I left the car.
"Thank you, Lynn,"
Hassan called out through the open window.
"Inshallah, we'll meet again soon."
The car drove off, and I turned toward the slum, staring at the gold-lettered business card for a full block before I put it in my pocket. A few minutes later, I passed the World Trade Center and entered the compound of the slum, remembering, as I always did, the first time I entered those blessed and tormented acres. As I passed Kumar's chai shop, Prabhakar came out to greet me. He was wearing a yellow silk shirt, black pants, and red and black patent leather high-heeled platform shoes. There was a crimson silk scarf tied at his throat.
"Oh, Lynn,"
he called out, hobbling across the broken ground on his platform shoes. He clung to me, as much for balance as in friendly greeting.
"There is someone, a fellow you know, he is waiting for you, in your house. But 1 minute, please, what happened on your face? And your shirts? Have you been having it some fights with some bad fellows? Array? Some fellow gave you a solid pasting. If you want me, I will go with you and tell that fellow he is a Bahinchud."
"It's nothing, Prabhu. It's okay," I muttered, striding toward the hut. "Do you know who it is?"
"Who it is? You mean, who it is who was hitting your face?"
"No, no, of course not. I mean the man who's waiting in my hut. Do you know who it is?"
"Yes, Lynn,"
he said, stumbling along beside me and clutching my sleeve for support. We walked on for a few more seconds in silence. People greeted us on every side, calling out invitations to share chai, food, or a smoke. "Well?" I asked after a while.
"Well? What well?"
"Well, who is it? Who's in my hut?"
"Oh," he laughed. "Sorry, Lynn. I thought you wanted some surprises, so I didn't tell you."
"It's hardly a surprise, Prabhu, because you told me there was someone waiting for me in my hut."
"No, no," he insisted. "You don't know it his name yet, so still you get the surprise. And that is a good thing. If I don't tell you there is somebody, then you go to your hut and you get the shocks. And that is a bad thing. A shocks is like a surprise when you are not ready."
"Thank you, Prabhu," I replied, my sarcasm evaporating as it was uttered. He needn't have concerned himself with sparing me the shock. The closer I came to my hut, the more often I was informed that a foreigner was waiting to see me. "Hello, Lynn Baba, there's a Gora in your house waiting for you." We arrived at my hut to find Didier, sitting in the shade of the doorway on a stool and fanning himself with a magazine.
"It's Didier,"
Prabhakar informed me, grinning happily.
"Yes. Thank you, Prabhu."
I turned to Didier, who rose to shake hands.
"This is a surprise. It's good to see you."
"And good to see you, my dear friend,"
Didier replied, smiling despite the distressing heat.
"But I must be honest, you look a little worse for wear, as Letty would say."
"It's nothing, a misunderstanding, that's all. Give me a minute to wash up." I stripped off my torn, bloody shirt and poured a third of a bucket of clean water from the clay matka. Standing on the flattened pile of stones beside my hut, I washed my face, arms and chest. Neighbours passed me as I washed, smiling when they caught my eye. There was an art to washing in that way, with no wasted drop of water and no excess of mess. I'd mastered that art, and it was one of the 100 little ways my life imitated theirs, and folded into the lotus of their loving, hoping struggle with fate. "Would you like a chai?" I asked Didier, as I slipped on a clean white shirt in the doorway of my hut. "We can go to Kumar's."
I just had one full cup, Prabhaka interjected before Didier could reply. But one more chai will be okay, for the friendship's sake, I think so.
He sat down with us in the rickety chai shop. 5 huts had been cleared to make space for a single large room. There was a counter made from an old bedroom dresser, a patchwork plastic roof, and benches for the customers, made from planks resting precariously on piles of bricks. All the materials had been looted from the building site beside the slum. Kumar, the chai shop owner, fought a running guerrilla war with his customers, who tried to pilfer his bricks and planks for their own houses. Kumar came to take our order himself. True to the general rule of slum life, that the more money one makes, the more poverty-stricken one had to look, Kumar's appearance was more dishevelled and ragged than the meanest of his customers. He dragged up a stained wooden crate for us to use as a table. Appraising it with a suspicious squint, he slapped at the crate with a filthy rag and then tucked the cloth into his singlet. Didier, you look terrible, I observed, when Kumar left to prepare our tea. Must be love. He grinned back at me, shaking his head of dark curls and raising the palms of his hands.
I am very fatigued, it is true, he said, managing a shrug of elaborate self-pity. People do not understand the truly fantastic effort required in the corruption of a simple man. And the more simple the man, the more effort it requires. They do not realize what it takes out of me to put so much decadence into a man who is not born to it.
You might be making a rod for your own back, I mocked.
Each thing in its own time, he replied, smiling thoughtfully. But you, my friend, you look very well. Only a little, how shall I say it, lonely for information. And to that end, Didier is here. I have all the latest news and gossip for you. You know the difference between news and gossip, don't you? News tells you what people did. Gossip tells you how much they enjoyed it.
We both laughed, and Prabhaka joined in, laughing so loudly that everyone in the chai shop turned to look at him.
Well then, Didier continued, where to start? Oh yes, Vikram's pursuit of Letitia proceeds with a certain bizarre inevitability. She began by loathing him.
I think loathing is a bit strong, I argued.
Ah yes, perhaps you're right. If she loathes me, and it is completely certain that she does, the dear and sweet English rose, then her feeling for Vikram was indeed something less. Shall we say, detest?
I think detest would cover it, I agreed.
Eh bien, she began by detesting him, but through the persistence of his devoted romantic attentions, he has managed to arouse in her what I can only describe as an amiable revulsion.
We laughed again, and Prabhaka slapped at his thigh, hooting with such hilarity that every head turned toward him. Didier and I inspected him with quizzical looks of our own. He responded with an impish smile, but I noticed that his eyes darted away quickly to his left. Following the glance, I saw his new love, Parvati, preparing food in Kumar's kitchen. Her thick black plait of hair was the rope by which a man might climb to heaven. Her petite figure, she was tiny, shorter even than Prabhaka, was the perfect shape of his desire. Her eyes, when she turned in profile to look at us, were black fire. Looking over Parvati's shoulder, however, was her mother, Nandita. She was a formidable woman, 3 times the combined width and weight of her petite daughters, Parvati and Sita, and she glowered at us, her expression managing to combine greed for our custom with contempt for our male sex. I smiled at her and wagged my head. Her smile, in return, was remarkably similar to the fierce grimace that Maori warriors affect to intimidate their enemies.
In his last episode, Didier continued, the good Vikram hired a horse from the handlers on Chaupati Beach and rode it to Letitia's apartment on Marine Drive to serenade her outside her window.
Did it work?
Unfortunately, no. The horse left a package of mud on the front pathway, during an especially moving part of the song, no doubt. And the many other residents of the apartment building expressed our outrage by pelting the poor Vikram with rotting food. Letitia, it was noticed, threw more offensive missiles and with a more deadly aim than any of the neighbors.
C'est l'amour, I sighed.
Exactly. Merde and bad food, c'est l'amour,
Didier agreed quickly.
I do think that I must involve myself in this romance, if it is to succeed. The poor Vikram, he is a fool for love, and Letty despises a fool above all else. But things are much more successful for Maurizio in the last time. He had some business venture with Modena, Ulla's paramour, and he is in the chips, as our dear Letty would say. He is now a significant dealer in Colaba.
I forced my face to remain impassive, while jealous thoughts of handsome Maurizio, flushed with success, spiked their way into my mind. The rain started again, and I glanced outside to see people running, hitching up their pants and their saris to avoid the many puddles.
Just yesterday, Didier went on,
carefully tipping his tea from the cup into the saucer, and sipping it from the saucer, as most of the slum dwellers did.
Modena arrived in a chauffeured car at Leopold's, and Maurizio is wearing a $10,000 Rolex watch. But,
I prompted, when he paused to drink.
Well, there is terrible risk in their business. Maurizio is not always honorable in his business dealings. If he should upset the wrong people, there will be great violence.
And what about you? I asked, changing the subject because I didn't want Didier to see the serpent of spite rising in me when he spoke of the trouble that might be finding its way to Maurizio. Aren't you flirting with danger yourself? Your new interest is one string short of the full marionette, or so I'm told. He's got a very bad temper, Letty says, and a hair trigger controlling it.
Oh, him,
he sniffed dismissively, turning down the corners of his expressive mouth.
Not at all. He's not dangerous. Although he is annoying, and annoying is worse than dangerous, n'est-ce pas? It is easier to live with a dangerous man than an annoying one.
Prabhakar went to buy 3 bidi cigarettes from Kumar's shop counter and lit them with the same match, holding them in one hand and burning the ends with the other. He passed one each to Didier and me and sat down again, smoking contentedly.
Ah, yes, there's another piece of news. Kavita has taken a new job at the newspaper, the Noonday. She is a features writer. It is a job with much prestige, I understand, and a fast track to a sub-editor's position. She won it in a field of many talented candidates, and she is very happy.
I like Kavita, I felt moved to say.
You know,
Didier offered, staring at the glowing end of his beady and then looking up at me, genuinely surprised.
So do I.
We laughed again, and I deliberately included Prabhakar in the joke. Parvati watched us from the corners of her smouldering eyes. Listen, I asked, seizing the momentary pause in our conversation. Does the name Hassan Obiqua mean anything to you? Didier's mention of Maurizio's new $10,000 Rolex had reminded me of the Nigerian. I fished the golden white business card from my shirt pocket and handed it over.
But of course, Didier replied. This is a famous Borsalino. They call him the body snatcher in the African ghetto.
Well, that's a good start, I muttered, a wry smile twisting my lips. Prabhakar slapped at his thigh and doubled over with near hysterical laughter. I put a hand on his shoulder to calm him down.
They say that when Hassan Obiqua snatches a body away, not even the devil himself can find it. They are never again seen by living men. Jamais. How do you come to know him? How did you get his card?
I sort of bumped into him earlier today, I answered, retrieving the card and slipping it into my pocket.
Well, be careful, my dear friend,
Didier sniffed, clearly hurt that I hadn't provided the details of my encounter with Hassan.
This Obiqua is like a king, a black king in his own kingdom. And you know the old saying, a king is a bad enemy, a worse friend, and a fatal family relation.
Just then, a group of young men approached us. They were labourers from the construction site, and most of them lived on the legal side of the slum. They'd all passed through my small clinic during the last year, most of them wanting me to patch up wounds they'd received in work accidents. It was payday at the site, and they were flushed with the excited optimism that a full pay packet puts into young, hard-working hearts. They shook hands with me, each in turn,
and paused long enough to see the new round of chai and sweet cakes they'd bought for us delivered to our table. When they left, I was grinning as widely as they were.
"This social work seems to suit you," Didier commented through an arch smile. "You look so well and so fit, underneath the bruises and scratches, that is. I think you must be a very bad man in your heart of hearts, Lin. Only a wicked man would derive such benefit from good works. A good man, on the other hand, would simply be worn out and bad-tempered."
"I'm sure you're right, Didier," I said, still grinning. "Carla said you're usually right about the wrong you find in people."
"Please, my friend," he protested. "You will turn my head."
The sudden crash of many drums exploded, thumping music directly outside the chai shop. Flutes and trumpets joined the drums, and a wild, raucous music began. I knew the music and the musicians well. It was one of the jangling popular tunes that the slum musicians played whenever there was a festival or a celebration. We all went to the open front of the shop. Prabhakar stood on a bench beside us to peer over the shoulders of the crowd.
"What is it? A parade?"
Didier asked, as we watched a large troop slowly walk past the shop.
"It's Joseph," Prabhakar cried, pointing along the lane. "Joseph and Maria, they're coming."
Some distance away, we could see Joseph and his wife, surrounded by relatives and friends, and approaching us with ceremonially slow steps. In front of them was a pack of capering children, dancing out their unself-conscious and near-hysterical enthusiasm. Some of them adopted poses from their favourite movie dance scenes and copied the steps of the stars. Others leapt about like acrobats or invented jerky, exuberant dances of their own. Listening to the band, watching the children, and thinking of Tariq, missing the boy already, I remembered an incident from the prison. In that other world within a world, back then, I moved into a new prison cell and discovered a tiny mouse there. The creature entered through a cracked air vent and crept into the cell every night. Patience and obsessional focus are the gems we mine in the tunnels of prison solitude. Using them and tiny morsels of food, I bribed the little mouse over several weeks and eventually trained it to eat from the edge of my hand. When the prison guards moved me from that cell in a routine rotation, I told the new tenant, a prisoner I thought I knew well, about the trained mouse. On the morning after the move, he invited me to see the mouse. He'd captured the trusting creature and crucified it, face down, on a cross made from a broken ruler. He laughed as he told me how the mouse had struggled when he'd tied it by its neck to the cross with cotton thread. He marvelled at how long it had taken to drive thumbtacks into its wriggling paws. Are we ever justified in what we do? That question ruined my sleep for a long time after I saw the tortured little mouse. When we act, even with the best of intentions, when we interfere with the world, we always risk a new disaster that mightn't be of our making, but that wouldn't occur without our action. Some of the worst wrongs, Carla once said, were caused by people who tried to change things. I looked at the slum children, dancing like a movie chorus and capering like temple monkeys. I was teaching some of those children to speak, read, and write English. Already, with just the little they'd learned in 3 months, a few of them were winning work from foreign tourists. Were those children, I wondered, the mice that fed from my hand? Would their trusting innocence be seized by a fate that wouldn't and couldn't have been theirs without me, without my intervention in their lives? What wounds and torments awaited Tariq, simply because I'd befriended and taught him?
"Joseph beat his wife," Prabhakar explained as the couple drew near. "Now the people are a big celebration."
"If they parade like this when a man beats his wife, what parties they must throw when one is killed,"
Didier commented, his eyebrows arched in surprise.
"He was drunk and he beat her terribly," I said, shouting above the din. "And a punishment was imposed on him by her family and the whole community."
"I gave to him a few good whacks with the stick my own self,"
Prabhakar added, his face aglow with happy excitement.
"Over the last few months, He worked hard, stayed sober, and did a lot of jobs in the community, I continued. It was part of his punishment, and a way of earning the respect of his neighbours again. His wife forgave him a couple of months ago. They've been working and saving money together. They've got enough now, and they're leaving today on a holiday.
Well, there are worse things for people to celebrate,
Didier decided, permitting himself a little shoulder and hip roll in time to the throbbing drums and snake flutes.
Oh, I almost forgot. There is a superstition, a famous superstition attached to that Hassan Obikwa. You should know about it.
I'm not superstitious, Didier, I called back over the thump and wail of the music.
Don't be ridiculous, he scoffed. Everyone in the whole world is superstitious.
That's one of Carla's lines, I retorted. He frowned, pursing his lips as he strained his memory to recall.
It is?
Absolutely, it's a Carla line, Didier.
Incredible, he muttered. I thought it was one of mine. Are you sure?
I'm sure.
Well, no matter. The superstition about him is that everyone who meets Hassan Obikwa and exchanges names with him in a greeting will one day find himself a client of his. Either a living client or a dead one. To avoid this fate, you don't tell him your name when you meet him the first time. No one ever does. You didn't tell him your name, did you?
A roar went up from the crowd surrounding us. Joseph and Maria were close. As they approached, I saw her radiant, hopeful, brave smile, and his competing expressions of shame and determination. She was beautiful, with her thick hair trimmed short and styled to match the modern cut of her best dress. He'd lost weight and looked fit, healthy and handsome. He wore a blue shirt and new trousers. Husband and wife pressed against one another tightly, step for step, all four hands balled into a bouquet of clenched fingers. Family members followed them, holding a blue shawl to catch notes and coins thrown by the crowd. Prabhakar couldn't resist the call to dance. He leapt off the bench and joined the thick tangle of jerking, writhing bodies that preceded Joseph and Maria on the track. Stumbling and tottering on his platform shoes, he skipped to the centre of the dancers. His arms were outstretched for balance, as if he was crossing a shallow river on a path of stones. His yellow shirt flashed as he whirled and lurched and laughed in the dance. Didier, too, was drawn into the avalanche of revelry that ploughed through the long lane to the street. I watched him glide and sway gracefully into the party, swept along in the rhythmic dance until only his hands were visible above his dark, curly hair. Girls threw showers of flower petals plucked from chrysanthemums. They burst in brilliant white clusters and settled on all of us in the converging crowd. Just before the couple passed me, Joseph turned to look into my eyes. His face was fixed between a smile and a frown. His eyes were burning, glistening beneath the tight brows of his frown, while his lips held a happy smile. He nodded twice before looking away. He couldn't know it, of course, but with that simple nod of his head, Joseph had answered the question that had remained with me, as a dull ache of doubt, since the prison. Joseph was saved. That was the look simmering in his eyes as he nodded his head. It was the fever of salvation. That look, that frowning smile, combined shame and exaltation, because both are essential. Shame gives exaltation its purpose, and exaltation gives shame its reward. We'd saved him as much by joining in his exaltation as we had by witnessing his shame. And all of it depended upon our action, our interference in his life. Because no man is saved without love. What characterizes the human race more, Carla once asked me? Cruelty or the capacity to feel shame for it? I thought the question acutely clever then, when I first heard it. But I'm lonelier and wiser now. And I know it isn't cruelty or shame that characterizes the human race. It's forgiveness that makes us what we are. Without forgiveness, our species would have annihilated itself in endless retributions. Without forgiveness, there would be no history. Without that hope, there would be no art. For every work of art is in some way an act of forgiveness. Without that dream, there would be no love. For every act of love is in some way a promise to forgive. We live on because we can love. And we love because we can forgive. The drums staggered toward the distant street. Moving away from us, the dancers romped and rolled on the rhythm, their swaying heads like a field of wildflowers, weaving back and forth on waves of wind. As the music dwindled to an echo in our minds, the day-to-day and minute-to-minute of slum life slowly reclaimed the lanes. We gave ourselves to our routines, our needs, and our harmless, hopeful scheming. And for a while, a little while, ours was a better world, because the hearts and smiles that ruled it were almost as pure and clean as the flower petals fluttering from our hair and clinging to our faces like still white tears. Shantaram by Gregory David Roberts. Continued. Disc 2. Chapter 18. The rocky cusp of coastline bordering the slum began in mangrove swamp at its left and swept through deeper water around a long new moon curve of white-crested wavelets to Nariman Point. The monsoon was at full strength, but just at that moment no rain fell from the grey-black ocean of the lightning-fractured sky. Wading birds swooped into the shallow swamp and nestled among the slender, trembling reeds. Fishing boats plied their nets on the ragged waves of the bay. Children swam and played along the bouldered, pebble-strewn shoreline. On the Golden Crescent, across the small bay, apartment towers for the rich stood shoulder to shoulder to shoulder, all the way to the embassy district at the point. In the large courtyards and recreation areas of those towers, the wealthy walked and took the air. Seen from the distant slum, the white shirts of the men and colourful saris of the women were like so many beads threaded by a meditating mind on the black strings of asphalt paths. The air there on that rocky fringe of the slum was clean and cool. The silences were large enough to swallow occasional sounds. The area was known as the Kalaba Back Bay. There were few places in the city better suited to the spiritual and physical stock-taking that a wanted man worries himself with when the omens are bad enough. I sat alone, on a boulder that was larger and flatter than most, and I smoked a cigarette. I smoked in those days because, like everyone else in the world who smokes, I wanted to die at least as much as I wanted to live. Sunlight suddenly pushed aside the sodden monsoon clouds, and for a few moments the windows of the apartment buildings across the bay were dazzling, brilliant mirrors of the golden sun. Then, horizon-wide, the rain clouds regrouped and slowly sealed the splendent circle of sky, herding one against another until heaven matched the rolling sea with dark, watery waves of cloud. I lit a new cigarette with the butt of the last and thought about love and thought about sex. Under pressure from Didier, who permitted his friends to keep any secrets but those of the flesh, I'd admitted that I hadn't made love to anyone since I'd arrived in India. "That is a very long time between the drinks, my friend," he'd said, gasping in horror, "and I propose that it would be a good idea to get very drunk, if you have my meaning, and very soon." And he was right, of course. The longer I went without it, the more important it seemed to become. I was surrounded in the slum by beautiful Indian girls and women who provoked small symphonies of inspiration. I never let my eyes or my thoughts wander too far in their direction. It would have compromised everything that I was and did as the slum doctor. But there were opportunities with foreign girls, tourists, in every other deal that I did with them, every other day. German, French, and Italian girls often invited me back to their hotel rooms for a smoke, once I'd helped them to buy hash or grass. I knew that something more than smoking was usually intended. And I was tempted. Sometimes I ached with it. But I couldn't get Carla out of my mind. And deep within me, I still don't know whether it's love or fear or good judgment that spawns such a feeling. I sensed with all of my intuition that if I didn't wait for her, it wouldn't happen. I couldn't explain that love to Carla, or anyone else, including myself. I never believed in love at first sight until it happened to me. Then, when it did happen, it was as if every atom in my body had been changed somehow. As if I'd become charged with light and heat. I was different forever, just for the sight of her. And the love that opened in my heart seemed to drag the rest of my life behind it, from that moment onward. I heard her voice in every lovely sound the wind wrapped around me. I saw her face in brilliant mirrored flares of memory every day. Sometimes when I thought of her, the hunger to touch her and to kiss her and to breathe a cinnamon-scented minute of her black hair clawed at my chest and crushed the air in my lungs. Clouds, heavy with their burden of monsoon rain, massed above the city, above my head, and it seemed to me in those weeks that all grey heaven was my brooding love. The very mangroves trembled with my desire, and at night, too many nights, it was my restive sleep that rolled and turned the sea in lustered dreaming, until the sun each morning rose with love for her. But she wasn't in love with me, she'd said, and she didn't want me to love her. Didier, trying to warn me, trying to help me or save me perhaps, had said once that nothing grieves more deeply or pathetically than one half of a great love that isn't meant to be. And he was right, of course, up to a point. But I couldn't let it go, that hope of loving her. And I couldn't ignore the instinct that enjoined me to wait and wait. Then there was that other love, a father's love, and the son's love that I felt for Kader Bhai. Lord Abdel Kader Khan. His friend, Abdul Ghani, had called him a mooring post, with the lives of thousands tied to his life for safety. My own life seemed to be one of those harnessed to his. Yet I couldn't clearly see the means by which fate had bound me to him. Nor was I completely free to leave. When Abdul had spoken of his search for wisdom, and the answers to his three big questions, he'd unwittingly described my own private search for something or someone to believe. I'd walked that same dusty, broken road towards a faith. But every time I'd heard the story of a belief, every time I'd seen some new guru, the result was the same. The story was unconvincing in some way, and the guru was flawed. Every faith required me to accept some compromise. Every teacher required me to close my eyes to some fault. And then there was Abdel Kader Khan, smiling at my suspicions with his honey-coloured eyes. Is he the real thing? I began to ask myself. Is he the one?
It is very beautiful, isn't it? Johnny Cigar asked, sitting beside me and staring out at the dark, impatient restlessness of the waves.
Yeah, I answered, passing him a cigarette.
Our life, it probably began inside of the ocean, Johnny said quietly, about 4,000 million years before now. Probably near hot places like volcanoes under the sea.
I turned to look at him.
And for almost all of that long time, all the living things were water things living inside the sea. Then, a few 100 million years ago, maybe a little more, just a little while, really, in the big history of the earth, the living things began to be living on the land as well.
I was frowning and smiling at the same time, surprised and bewildered. I held my breath, afraid that any sound might interrupt his musing.
But in a way, you can say that after leaving the sea, after all those millions of years of living inside of the sea, we took the ocean with us. When a woman makes a baby, she gives it water inside her body to grow in. That water inside her body is almost exactly the same as the water of the sea. It is salty by just the same amount. she makes a little ocean in her body. And not only this, our blood and our sweating, they are both salty, almost exactly like the water from the sea is salty. We carry oceans inside of us, in our blood and our sweat. And we are crying the oceans in our tears. He fell silent, and at last I spoke my amazement.
Where the hell did you learn that? I snapped, perhaps a little harshly.
I read it in the book, he replied,
turning to me with shy concern in his brave brown eyes.
Why, is it wrong? Have I said it wrongly? I have the book in my house. Shall I get it for you?
No, no, it's right. It's perfectly right. It was my turn to lapse into silence. I was furious with myself. Despite my intimate knowledge of the slum dwellers and the debt I owed them, they'd taken me in and given me all the support and friendship their hearts could hold, I still fell into the bigot's trap. Johnny shocked me with his knowledge, because somewhere in my deepest appraisal of the slum dwellers, there was a prejudice that they had no right to such knowledge. In my secret heart, I judged them as ignorant, even though I knew better, simply because they were poor.
Lynn! Lynn!
My neighbour Jitendra called out in a frightened shriek, and we turned to see him clambering over the rocks towards us.
Lynn! My wife! My Radha! She is very sick!
What is it? What's the matter?
She has bad loose motions. She's very hot with fever, and she's vomiting,
Jitendra puffed.
She's looking bad. She's looking very bad.
Let's go, I grunted, jumping up and leaping from stone to stone until I reached the broken path leading back to the slum. We found Radha lying on a thin blanket in her hut. Her body was twisted into a knot of pain. Her hair was wet, saturated with sweat, as was the pink sari she wore. The smell in the hut was terrible. Chandrika, Jitendra's mother, was trying to keep her clean, but Radha's fever rendered her incoherent and incontinent. She vomited again violently as we watched, and that provoked a new dribble of diarrhea. When did it start?
2 days ago,
Jitendra answered, desperation drawing down the corners of his mouth in a grimace.
2 days ago.
You were out someplace with tourists very late. Then you were at Kasim Ali, his house, until late last night. Then you were also gone today from very early. You were not here. At the first I thought it was just a loose motions, but she's very sick, Lin Baba. I tried 3 times to get her in the hospital, but they will not take her.
She has to go back to hospital, I said flatly. She's in trouble, Jitu.
What to do, what to do, Lin Baba?
He whined, tears filling his eyes and spilling on his cheeks.
They will not take her. There are too many people at the hospital, too many people. I waited for 6 hours today altogether, 6 hours, in the open, with all other sick peoples. In the end, she was begging me to come back to here, to her house. So ashamed she was. So I came back just now. That's why I went searching for you and called you only. I'm very worried, Lin Baba.
I told him to throw out the water in his matka, wash it out thoroughly, and get fresh water. I instructed Chandrika to boil fresh water until it bubbled for 10 minutes, and then to use that water, when it cooled, as drinking water for Radha. Jitendra and Johnny came with me to my hut, where I collected glucose tablets and a paracetamol codeine mixture. I hoped to reduce her pain and fever with them. Jitendra was just leaving with the medicine when Prabhaka rushed in. There was anguish in his eyes and in the hands that grasped me.
Lin, Lin, Parvati is sick, very sick. Please come too fast.
The girl was writhing in the spasm of an agony that centered on her stomach. She clutched at her belly and curled up in a ball, only to fling her arms and legs outward in a back-arching convulsion. Her temperature was very high. She was slippery with sweat. The smells of diarrhea and vomit were so strong in the deserted chai shop that the girl's parents and sister held cloths to their mouths and noses. Parvati's parents, Kumar and Nandita Patak, were trying to cope with the illness,
but their expressions were equally helpless and defeated. It was a measure of their despondency and their fear that dread had banished modesty, and they allowed the girl to be examined in a flimsy undergarment that revealed her shoulders and most of one breast. Terror filled the eyes of Parvati's sister, Sita. She hunched in a corner of the hut, her pretty face pinched and cramped by the horror she felt. It wasn't an ordinary sickness, and she knew it. Johnny Sagar spoke to the girl in Hindi. His tone was harsh, almost brutal. He warned her that her sister's life was in her hands, and he admonished her for her cowardice. Moment by moment, his voice guided her out of the forest of her black fear. At last she looked up and into his eyes, as if seeing him for the first time. She shook herself, and then crawled across the floor to wipe her sister's mouth with a piece of wet toweling. With that call to arms from Johnny Sagar, and the simple, solicitous gesture from Sita, the battle began. Cholera. By nightfall there were 10 serious cases, and a dozen more possible. By dawn the next day there were 60 advanced cases, and as many as 100 with some symptoms. By noon, on that day, the first of the victims died. It was Radha, my next-door neighbour. The official from the Bombay Municipal Corporation's Department of Health was a tired, astute, condolent man in his early 40s named Sandeep Jyoti. His compassionate eyes were almost the same shade of dark tan as his glistening, sweat-oily skin. His hair was unkempt, and he pushed it back frequently with the long fingers of his right hand. Around his neck there was a mask, which he lifted to his mouth whenever he entered a hut or encountered one of the victims of the illness. He stood together with Dr. Hamid, Kasim Ali Hussein, Prabhakar, and me, near my hut after making his first examination of the slum.
"We'll take these samples and have them analysed," he said, nodding to an assistant who filed blood, sputum, and stool samples in a metal carry case. "But I'm sure you're right, Hamid. There are 12 other cholera outbreaks between here and Kandivli. They're small, mostly. But there's a bad one in Thane. More than 100 new cases every day. All the local hospitals are overcrowded. But this is not bad, really, for the monsoon. We hope we can keep a cap on it at 15 or 20 infection sites."
I waited for one of the others to speak, but they simply nodded their heads gravely. "We've got to get these people to hospital," I said at last.
"Look," he replied, glancing around him and drawing a deep breath. "We can take some of the critical cases. I'll arrange it. But it's just not possible to take everyone. I'm not going to tell you any lies. It's the same in 10 other hutments. I've been to them all, and the message is the same. You have to fight it out here. On your own. You have to get through it."
"Are you out of your fucking mind?" I snarled at him, feeling the fear prowl in my gut. "We already lost my neighbour Radha this morning. There's 30,000 people here. It's ridiculous to say we have to fight it out ourselves. You're the health department, for God's sake." Sandeep Jyoti watched his assistant close and secure the sample cases. When he turned back to me, I saw that his bloodshot eyes were angry. He resented the indignant tone, especially coming from a foreigner, and was embarrassed that his department couldn't do more for the slum dwellers. If it hadn't been so obvious to him that I lived and worked in the slum, and that the people liked me as much as they relied on me, he would have told me to go to hell. I watched all those thoughts shift across his tired, handsome face, and then I saw the patient, resigned, almost affectionate smile that replaced them as he ran a hand through his untidy hair.
"Look, I really don't need a lecture from a foreigner, from a rich country, about how badly we look after our own people, or the value of a human life. I know you're upset, and Hamid tells me you do a good job here, but I deal with this situation every day all over the state. There are 100 million people in Maharashtra, and we value them all. We do our best."
"Sure you do," I sighed in return, reaching out to touch his arm. "I'm sorry.
I didn't mean to take it out on you. I'm way out of my depth here, and I guess I'm scared.
Why do you stay here when you can leave?
It was an abrupt question under the circumstances, and almost rude. I couldn't answer it. I don't know. I love this city. Why do you stay?
He studied my eyes for a moment longer, and then his frown softened again in a gentle smile.
What help can you give us? Dr. Hamid asked.
Not much, I'm sorry to say.
He looked at the dread in my eyes and heaved a sigh from the hill of exhaustion in his heart.
I'll arrange for some trained volunteers to come and give you a hand. I wish I could do more, but I'm sure that you all can handle it here. Probably a lot better than you think, just at this moment. You've already made a good start. Where did you get the salts?
I brought them, Hamid answered quickly, because the ORT salts had been supplied illegally by Kadarbai's lepers. When I told him I thought we had cholera here, he brought the ORTs and told me how to use them, I added. But it's not easy. Some of these people are too sick to hold them down.
ORT, or oral rehydration therapy, had been devised by John Rode, a scientist who worked with local and UNICEF doctors in Bangladesh during the late 1960s and early 1970s. The oral rehydration solution that he developed contained distilled water, sugar, common salt, and other minerals in carefully mixed proportions. Rode knew that what kills people who are contaminated with the cholera bacterium is dehydration. The ugly fact is that they shit and vomit themselves to death. He discovered that a solution of water, salt, and sugar kept people alive long enough for the bacterium to pass through their systems. Ranjit's lepers, at Dr. Hamid's request, had given me boxes of the solution. I had no idea how much more of the stuff we could expect to receive, or how much we would need.
We can get you a delivery of salts, Sandeep Jyoti said. We'll get them to you as soon as possible. The city is stretched to its limits, but I'll make sure you get a team of volunteers here as soon as we can send them. I'll put a priority on it.
Good luck.
We watched in grim silence as he followed his assistant out of the slum. We were all afraid. Kasim Ali Hussein took control. He declared his home to be a command center. We called a meeting there, and some 20 men and women gathered to devise a plan. Cholera is largely a waterborne disease. The Vibrio cholerae bacterium spreads from contaminated water and lodges itself in the small intestine, producing the fever, diarrhea, and vomiting that cause dehydration and death. We determined to purify the slum's water, beginning with the holding tanks and then moving on to the pots and buckets in each of the 7,000 huts. Kasim Ali produced a bundle of rupee notes as thick as a man's knee and gave it to Johnny Sagar, deputing him to buy the water purification tablets and other medicines we would need. Because so much rainwater had accumulated in puddles and rivulets throughout the slum, those too had provided breeding grounds for the bacteria. It was decided that a chain of shallow trenches would be established at strategic points in the lanes of the slum. They would be filled with disinfectant, and each person walking the lane would be required to pass through the ankle-deep antiseptic drench. Plastic bins for safe disposal of waste materials were to be placed at designated points, and antiseptic soap would be given to every household. Soup kitchens would be established in the chai shops and restaurants to provide safe boiled food and sterilized cups and bowls. A team was also assigned to the task of removing the bodies of the dead and taking them on a trundle cart to the hospital. My task was to supervise the use of the oral rehydration solution and to prepare batches of a homemade mixture as required. They were all huge undertakings and onerous responsibilities, but no man or woman at the gathering hesitated in accepting them. It's a characteristic of human nature that the best qualities, called up quickly in a crisis, are very often the hardest to find in a prosperous calm,
The contours of all our virtues are shaped by adversity. But there was another reason, far from virtue, for my own eagerness to accept the tasks.